I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. This week, children at play. In Haiti, young earthquake refugees make toys out of trash. They jump rope with an old construction cord. They slide down hills on flattened juice bottles. And 9-year-old Pedro flies a kite made from 2 sticks of wood and a grocery bag.
I love it when it looks like it's sleeping. When it's so high up and it's not moving, and so it's just sleeping. It's just floating in the air.
Plus, we take you to Skatistan.
I come from a family of 9. My brother and I are the only ones who can work. There's no way I could afford a skateboard of my own, so I'm glad I can come here, even if it's just once a week.
And ultrasound comes to Sudan. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The recent election in Sudan returned the president to power and ensured that nothing much is going to change in that troubled country, certainly not the healthcare system or lack thereof. In the South, 1 in 50 women die in childbirth. That's one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world. John Dow was one of the Lost Boys, the group of boys who, during the Civil War, walked thousands of miles to safety in neighboring countries. Now he's raised enough money to build the largest health clinic in the region where he grew up. We'll hear from John in a moment. But first, let's go to the clinic he helped build. David Shunatri has our report from the village of Dupayuel.
It's late in the evening, but the staff at the Duke County Lost Boys Clinic has been called back to work. A young woman has been brought in on the back of a truck that traveled over miles of bumpy dirt road to get here. She recently had a baby. Now she lies on an examination table in a bare concrete room, critically ill.
She delivered 1.5 months ago.
Did she bleed?
She bled a lot.
Yeah.
She's surrounded by 6 women from her extended family, a midwife, and the clinic medical officer. A diesel generator keeps the light on. Other family members are waiting in the hallway in the dark.
How are you feeling now?
A nurse cools the woman down with a wet sponge. Room temperature. There's no ice here. She can barely speak. This young woman represents many of the problems that make giving birth so risky in South Sudan. She's had 4 children by the age of 25. She's had no prenatal care despite a high-risk pregnancy. She suffered postpartum bleeding, and she gave birth at home on a dirt floor. Harina Yemba Dock is a Kenyan midwife who works here.
So she has a fever?
She has a fever. We are suspecting infection.
There are no hospitals in the 6,000 square miles of Duke County where the clinic is located, and no paved roads.
There are no means even to transport the mothers to the hospital and their complications. So most of the people who conduct deliveries or who see the mothers, they just see the mothers dying or the children dying.
But the woman brought in this night, so close to death, survived, thanks to getting one of the first blood transfusions at this bare-bone clinic, where the walls don't always reach the ceiling. Birds roost in the rafters, and bats occasionally dart in and out of examining rooms. But there's a pharmacist here dispensing medications from a window by the entrance. A new well provides clean water. 9 solar panels power a cold room where vaccines are stored.
We're in the labor and delivery suite, and it doesn't look pretty, but it has all the essentials of a relatively clean and medically attended labor and delivery experience by very experienced, trained midwives.
Dr. David Reed practices emergency medicine in Syracuse, New York, and has volunteered in developing countries around the world. He now advises the foundation that runs the clinic. He's in contact with the staff here almost every day and visits at least twice a year. He says one of his most memorable moments happened a couple of years ago when a village birth attendant in desperation brought in a woman she was trying to help.
I think probably for the first time ever I put sterile gloves on the hands of this untrained traditional village birth attendant, and we worked together to help a very difficult delivery process occur here, and a healthy child was born after many hours of difficult labor.
The midwives on staff here encouraged those traditional birth attendants to send pregnant women to the clinic for prenatal care and to have their babies. That's why Rebecca Yam came here.
And was her delivery eventful? Was there any problem?
The 38-year-old walked 3 hours in 90-degree heat to get here. She patiently answers a midwife's questions about her last pregnancy. The twins she was carrying died. Now she thinks she may be pregnant again. Tall and slender, wearing a long purple robe, she has a regal bearing. But like almost everyone else here, she is extremely poor. And like almost everyone, she knows women who have died giving birth.
For all these years, we didn't know what killed us or our kids. Now there are new discoveries, so some can find out what used to kill them. Now we come to the clinic. We believe all this in our bodies will go away.
So I'm just going to put it on here. Cold.
Moments later, Yam lay on an examination table and experienced one of those new discoveries. She got the first ultrasound ever in Duke County, thanks to Dr. Reed, who brought the donated technology with him on this latest visit. And Yam also got a piece of news.
Can I see the baby? Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So pivot. That's the stomach bubble there. And see the heart beating? Yeah. So let's go.
The staff at the Duke County Lost Boys Clinic now sees more than 100 patients a day, many of them pregnant women. Dr. Reed said he's trying to build a clinic that can be sustained without outside help.
Because our end point is to try and hand this complete clinic and its function over to the Ministry of Health, the people of South Sudan, and be out of the picture. That's the end point. See the heartbeat?
Oh.
Yeah.
You see the eyes?
Yeah.
Can you see this?
Yeah.
Yeah? Does she see it? That's your baby.
For the World Vision Report, I'm David Chinatry in Duke Payuel, Sudan.
John Dow joins me now. He's the former Lost Boy of Sudan who's responsible for building the clinic you just heard about. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, of all the things you could have done after escaping Sudan and building a life here for yourself in the United States, why did you decide to go back to Sudan and build a medical clinic in the village where you once lived?
One thing is that, you know, came to the United States, got help from many people, enjoy the life that we have here in America. And it was not meant for me just sit here, come from Africa in a war that, destroy a country, stay here, enjoy myself, and forget people back. I thought the better gift that I will give to my people back in Africa is to build a medical clinic. That's what I always say. This is what the Lord want. This is what God want. God want us to receive things and also distribute it to other people.
I would think as a refugee here, after all you had been through, it was a tremendous struggle just for you to survive and provide for your family. How did you end up raising enough money to actually build this amazing medical clinic in Sudan?
This is no secret. People in the United States are very generous. I have never, ever seen such a big-hearted, generous people like Americans. When I talk to people, universities, corporations, schools, synagogues, churches, about the needs in my country, in southern Sudan, we need medical clinic, we need school, we need road, we need agriculture, business, all these things. People, they would just say, okay, you know, how can I help? Others would just say, okay, here's my check. Others would say, oh, I'm going to volunteer. And so it is not very difficult in the United States to actually get the thing done.
Now, John, you have been back to Sudan many times since then, and you've seen the clinic. And we just heard in the story before this interview, what a big difference this clinic is making in your community. That must be quite an experience for you to go back and see all the people being helped there. What's that like?
Peggy, you know, it is really rewarding. And I always think, thank you, God, for making this happen. Now, the clinic I'm talking about, we have been treating so many people, over 500 children being vaccinated, over 600 mothers gave birth at the clinic or being taken care of, you know, at the clinic. We are doing HIV-8 care right now. And actually, we just sent our ultrasound for the first time.
You sound very passionate about the work you're investing in the Sudan.
Well, I think it's because I think it's my duty to help my people, to help people that cannot help themselves.
You were once one of those people who could not help yourself. Many people listening will know the stories of the Lost Boys of Sudan. I'm wondering if you could tell us just a little of your own story of getting out of Sudan. You fled on foot during the brutal civil war there, like about 20,000 other young boys separated from your parents. What do you remember and how old were you?
When my village was attacked in 1987, I was 13 years old. we were attacked in the middle of the night. And since that night, I was separated from my family. You know, in the United States, when you go for one day without food, you said you're going to die. I have to tell you, there was nothing to eat. We live on wild fruits.
For how long?
About three months. Eating grass like a cow, like animal, and being beaten by the enemy. And, you know, at night, there's nothing cover yourself. It was very cold. And from there, we're being chased by many wild animals, such as hyenas, lions, and many people of, you know, the Lost Boys whom we met on the way, you know, died because of hunger, died because of thirst. We found mud. Mud is like mashed potatoes. We add it, help a little bit, and then drink human urine too. By the time we got to, we found good water, clean water, we were only four and we were about 27. But then we lost about 23 of us, either killed, died because of starvation or thirst, eaten by a wild animal at night, or killed by other diseases.
Was there ever a moment on that three-month journey when you wondered, am I really going to make it?
Yes, there has been many, many times from my village to Ethiopia that I thought, oh, I think the next person will be me. But then I would say, well, I have to die fighting. I have to move forward. You know, maybe I will get water or get something to eat or get help. So I never lost hope.
You have really made something of your life. You came to the United States. You've been here about 10 years. You've completed college. You've worked multiple jobs to support yourself. You've gotten married. You've started a family. How have you managed to do all of this after all you've been through?
Well, in my 8 years in America, I would say, you know, anything that come as a challenge, such as working two jobs or three jobs, such as taking care of my family, such as building clinic, whatever seemed to be difficult in America or seemed to be a big challenge in the United States, I think to me is it become piece of cake because it remind me about what I went through before. And so once that come up, what I went through, like thirsty and starvation and all of this, I'm happy that I went through that difficult thing first before other things. So it make everything that I'm going through right now so small.
Well, John, we wish you the very best as you continue your work on behalf of the people in Sudan. And we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was John Dow, one of the Lost Boys of Sudan. There's a series of photos to go with this story on our website, worldvisionreport.org. If you had fish for dinner last night, it might have come from Thailand. Meet a man who might have caught your fish. He's a seafood slave. That story after a short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Thailand has been rocked by anti-government protests over the last few weeks. Protesters claim the government is illegitimate and undemocratic. But the country remains attractive to thousands of illegal immigrants from Burma. They want jobs in the massive seafood industry. The industry is so large, it supplies most of the seafood you and I put on our tables. But most consumers are unaware that the seafood they're eating could have been caught by a seafood slave. Patrick Nguyen reports.
The Gulf of Thailand once seemed to hold great promise for Winko. The skinny, shy 24-year-old was barely surviving as a metal worker in his native Burma. But he heard the ports in Thailand offered endless jobs for young men willing to toil on the sea.
The economy in Burma is horrible. You barely make enough to eat. I thought coming to Thailand would improve my life.
Winko paid a trafficker his entire savings, $350, to smuggle him over the border. The broker found him a job on a fishing boat. What he didn't explain is that quitting would not be an option. Winko was thrown into a dark, locked room with 10 other Burmese men who'd fallen for the same scam. They were prisoners of a Thai fishing syndicate, and soon they were forced to fish for zero pay.
Everyone on the boat was treated so badly. People who didn't know what to do were kicked.
Once, Winko witnessed one of his fellow workers kicked overboard for complaining to the captain. He watched his crewmate slip below the water's surface as the boat motored onwards.
I only saw one killing, but I heard about many.
After 8 months on the sea, Winko escaped. When his boat docked in Chonburi province, Winko leapt off the boat and ran into the underbrush. He'll never know if he was chased because he never looked back.
I didn't even have a weapon. If I had needed to turn around and fight, I would have.
Winko now lives in a safe house in Samut Sakhon province, the heart of Thailand's seafood industry. He's afraid, both of deportation and the trafficker. He's being sheltered by an organization called the Labor Rights Promotion Network. Piakrai Silakot is an officer with the group. He often hears stories of men who've either escaped or are finally turned loose after months of grueling labor.
If you can withstand the sickness and injury, you eventually can get help when you come ashore. If you can't and you die, they'll throw you into the sea. Those are your only options.
Most Thai seafood shipped to the U.S. ends up in seaside processing centers like this. There are dozens of plants along the Gulf where workers take in the day's catch and ready seafood for distribution. Some of these hot, crowded factories have also relied on forced labor, according to a 2009 U.S. Labor Department report. They're also the places, Piakrai says, where slave-harvested seafood disappears into the supply chain.
After the seafood goes through these factories, the main markets are Europe and America. And I wonder, do those people know they're eating the product of forced labor?
The U.S. State Department has studied seafood slavery, but says there's no way to gauge how much Thailand's fishing industry relies on it. The Thai government has raided processing centers in recent years, freeing trafficking victims. But these arrests typically take place on land. The Gulf is much more difficult to police, and that's why fishing attracts so much abuse, Piakrai says. Cops are ill-equipped for boat raids, and law enforcement largely ignores labor violations at sea.
The Thai government and all governments need to face the reality. There's cruelty out on these fishing boats.
Winko's safe house sits just a mile or two from this port, where lean men offload buckets of shrimp from wooden boats. Despite the grief he's encountered, he feels he has no choice but to look for another job in the seafood trade. He's hoping to secure a foreign guest worker permit, which provides some insurance against abuse. Winko says he realizes his labor may have provided dinner for wealthy foreigners, but he doesn't hold them responsible.
My anger is more directed towards the boat owner and the broker. I'm angry I was tricked. I'm angry I was paid nothing.
The U.S. Labor Department is increasingly concerned about men like Winko. So it's pressing Thailand's shrimp industry to crack down on forced labor or face the ultimate penalty, sanctions against lucrative seafood exports to American grocery stores. For the World Vision Report, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Samut Sakhon, Thailand.
We're not hearing much about Haiti these days. Oil spills and car bomb plots have taken over the headlines. But we're keeping our eyes on Haiti, where people are still in real trouble. 4 months after the earthquake, thousands of Haitians still live in displacement camps, surviving on food handouts and limited water supplies. Still, the kids in the camps are doing what kids do best. They're playing. Here's Grant Fuller with a toy story from Port-au-Prince.
9-year-old Pedro stares at the sky and carefully lets out a spool of string as he maneuvers his homemade kite.
When I'm flying them, it's just a nice feeling. I love it when it looks like it's sleeping. When it's so high up and it's not moving, as the wind's pulling it, you're pulling it back just a little bit. and so it's just sleeping. It's just floating in the air.
Pedro's dreamlike description of kite flying stands in stark contrast to the harsh post-quake reality around him. He lives with his family in this giant, teeming displacement camp. Pedro's parents can't afford to buy him toys, but that's okay with him. All he needs are a few sticks of coconut wood, a plastic grocery bag, some string that was donated to families for their tents, and a little creativity.
First, I take two pieces of wood. I bind them together, and I kind of like turn them into a V. Then I take another piece and put it right next to them, and another, until it makes a circle. And then I take any type of material I have and cover those sticks. And I take string, and I wrap each end of the stick with it, and then I decorate it.
His latest kite features a bag with black stripes and makeshift streamers cut into it. This is a common sight in places of extreme poverty around the world, kids improvising their own toys. Usually, they end up turning trash into treasure. Here in this camp, the signs of creative kids are everywhere. A bunch of smiling preteen girls play jump rope with a long cord left over from the building of a shelter. They yell out one sweet as they turn the rope nice and easy, and then one hot as they whip it around and slap it hard against the ground. On the other side of camp, a gang of little boys slide down a short hillside, sitting on lids, flattened plastic bottles, or any shred of plastic they can find. Other kids pretend to film all the action with juice bottle camcorders. They cut a square in one side and flip it out for the screen, cut a slit in the other side for a hand strap, and a hole in the bottom for the lens. An 8-year-old Jean-Max Unley pulls his toy car along the dirt path by a string. He made it with a plastic juice bottle, lollipop sticks for the axles, and water bottle caps for the wheels. He says the car picks up rocks and hauls them around. That's for when my car gets a flat tire, he says, so I can use the rock to change it. Jean-Max also has one more bottle cap thoughtfully placed on top of the car. That's my spare tire, he says. When it comes to their toys, these kids have thought of everything. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Grant sent us photos and a blog to go with this story. They're on the web, worldvisionreport.org.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said. Boy, you got a friend in me.
Millions of people all around the world donated money to Haiti after they saw the terrible images following the earthquake. Charitable giving can be an emotional response to a disaster or a rational, thought-out plan. There's a new book out about how we make these choices. It's called The Hidden Brain. Author Shankar Vedantam says the reasons we choose to give or not to give are complex. He told us this story to illustrate his point.
This was an incident that took place some years ago where a dog got stranded on a tanker that was abandoned on the Pacific Ocean. The crew were rescued, but the dog got left behind. And over the next several weeks, the Humane Society in Hawaii and very large numbers of people from the rest of the country came together in an enormous animal rescue effort that cost many tens of thousands of dollars to rescue the dog. And I explore the story as a way of getting at a paradox, which is that on the one case, human beings are able to show such extraordinary compassion in rescuing individuals, individual animals, or individual people. And yet, on the other hand, the same human beings often are greatly reluctant to intervene when it comes to mass suffering, such as famine or earthquake or mass tragedy. The point that I was really trying to make was not so much the distinction between dogs and people, but between the distinction between one and many. If there were 100 dogs on the ship or 1,000 dogs on the ship, the tragedy would have been many times worse, but I suspect that people would have cared much less because they wouldn't have had a single face and a story and a name around which they could wrap their compassion and empathy.
What is that all about? How are our brains wired to do that?
Well, I call it the telescope effect. Our empathic systems are really designed to focus on individual others. And so when you think about an individual person who needs help, a single child, a single animal, it's very easy for us to put ourselves in this other creature's shoes and imagine what it would be like if we were in that creature's shoes. And this prompts us to act, and often act very heroically and very generously. However, when you have mass tragedy, when you have thousands of people affected or millions of people affected, our empathic systems break down because they really are designed, again, to focus on individual others. And when you have a large number of people, it's very difficult to put yourself in the shoes of a million people. Intellectually, we know that it's a great tragedy, that it has enormous consequences, but our intuitive, emotional, empathic systems are designed to focus in this telescope kind of fashion, where they're focused on the suffering of individual creatures who need our help.
You also actually cite an experiment that was done not with a dog, but two children. And you found that even with two children in the same amount of need, people's empathic responses seemed to diminish.
That's right. This is research by the psychologist Paul Slovic at the University of Oregon. He asked volunteers how much they were willing to give to help a little girl who needed their assistance. And volunteers were willing to give a certain amount of money. And then he asked them, well, how much would you give if it were a little boy instead? And volunteers were willing to give about the same amount of money. But when he presented both the boy and the girl together and said, here are two children in need of help, how much are you willing to give? The volunteers gave less. And the reason I cited this is that journalists and commentators often think that compassion fatigue sets in when the number of victims rises to an astronomical number, 1,000 or 100,000 or 1,000,000. And what this experiment suggests is that compassion fatigue really begins when the number of victims goes from 1 to 2. And the paradox is, at an intellectual conscious level, of course we know that the two children are more deserving of help than any one child, just as we know that 1,000,000 people are more deserving of help than a single individual. It's just that there is a tension between what we know consciously and these unconscious processes in our minds that cause us to elevate the importance of the one over the importance of the many.
Do you consider a kind of moral dilemma here?
There certainly is a moral dilemma. The paradox here, actually, is that people often attribute human inaction in the face of mass suffering to callousness or people not caring enough. But I don't think that really is the problem, because you can show in any number of situations that human beings act in enormously compassionate and empathetic ways. And so in some ways, what's happened over the last 100 years is that technology, especially, has allowed us to become aware of suffering that's taken place in distant lands. So 100 years ago or 150 years ago, if there was an earthquake in Haiti, we wouldn't know about it in the United States for weeks or perhaps months. And now we know about it within minutes and hours because of television and technology and mass communication. And so in some ways, our minds have not had a chance to catch up with what our technology has provided us.
How do you move people to pay attention to their conscious minds and look at the numbers of people suffering rather than just respond to their intuitive empathy for one?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to make people aware that this bias actually exists in their heads. We will always have the unconscious minds that we have for the foreseeable future. And so in some ways, if we wish to live up to our highest moral ideals, we have to set up the institutions that can do for us what our unconscious, intuitive systems cannot do for us. And so it's institutions in some ways that can respond quickly when there is mass suffering, that can respond appropriately when there is mass suffering.
What institutions are you referring to here?
Certainly, I think humanitarian groups would be one set of such institutions. But I am certainly thinking of governments, and I am certainly thinking of international agencies as well. The point is, if as a citizen of the United States, I know that I have some responsibility to the people of Haiti, how do I bring my empathy to bear to say I want to contribute something that is proportional to the size of the tragedy that can actually make a difference to help? We have come to often see charity as being a substitute for governmental and intergovernmental action. And I don't think it ever will be a substitute, because charity depends on the heartstrings of individuals to be pulled, And individual heartstrings are pulled by individual stories of tragedy and not necessarily by mass stories of tragedy, at least not in a proportional sense. When you look at how many humanitarian agencies fundraise right now, they will tell you that your contribution can help a specific child with a specific name and a specific life story in this distant country. And that turns out to be much more effective in getting people to contribute money than to tell them, look, there are a million people who are suffering from famine, or there are 10 million children who are in need of vaccinations in this country.
Right. It seems all charity groups do that. And I even think of journalists like myself. When we tell stories, we're aware that it's always more effective, it seems to be, to tell the story of one person and then maybe in a line or two expand to how many are involved like this. Is this contributing to the problem?
Well, here's the paradox, because on the one hand, it activates our sense of empathy, and I think that's fundamentally a good thing. And it's a good thing that, you know, when a journalist writes a story about an individual victim in Haiti, we feel compelled to act. The paradox is that there are many other tragedies that cannot be depicted in the same kind of fashion because the victims aren't bleeding in front of us. The victims are distant. We don't have a photograph of the victim in front of us. We don't have a name in front of us. We don't have a life story in front of us. And so in some ways, what the media have trained us to do and what the humanitarian agencies are training us to do by capitalizing in some ways on our internal moral compasses responding to these individual stories is that they're persuading people in some ways that the problem can be solved by responding to the individual story of tragedy. And what I'm trying to say is that much of the problem cannot be solved in this fashion. If we think of ourselves as being moral human beings and we want to live up to our highest moral values, we have to set in place systems that say, even when my heartstrings are not being pulled, I'm going to react empathetically. I'm going to react compassionately and generously.
Shankar Vedantam is author of The Hidden Brain. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Next, we head to Skatistan. Find out where that is, just ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's not uncommon to hear gunfire in Kabul. But that's not gunfire. It's skateboarders. They're trying out new moves at Kabul's first ever skateboarding school. It's been a big hit with both boys and girls since it opened last year. But skateboarding is just part of the story. Will Everett reports.
On a Sunday afternoon in Kabul, about 20 girls sit at desks arranged in a horseshoe. Some of these preteens come from educated families. Others are poor street kids. They all look like they'd rather be somewhere else, namely, the vast skate park that lies just beyond the classroom door. That's going to be the payoff for this hour of class time. But first things first.
We're going to play a little role game so we can see where we all come from. Then we're going to do a little story drawing before we do the skating today.
That's Sophie Friedel, a German volunteer with Skatistan, the country's first skateboarding school. It's run by a group of dedicated skateboarders from all over the world. And like the girls in this classroom, Sophie is also crazy about skateboarding. But first she wants to teach the kids something about diversity and getting along. She has them move their desks to the wall. Then she has them imagine a map of Afghanistan on the floor. With the help of a translator, she has them walk to the parts of the country where their families come from.
So this is Kabul, okay? I'm standing in Kabul.
The girls comply, scattering across the improvised map, some to the central Hazara lands, others to the Pashtun areas of the south and points in between.
The goal is really to teach them about like different ethnic backgrounds and trying to make them like make peace by providing them with the opportunity to meet people from other backgrounds.
Some 200 boys and girls participate in the weekly sessions. Sophie admits that the 60,000 square foot indoor skate park the kids will soon head into is really just a pretext.
Skateboarding is just a hook. It's not about skateboarding. It's about the most important thing is the peace building. The kids can see that those people are just people as well, and they can make friends and they can kind of communicate together. And I think that's really important. That's the most important thing.
Sophie hands out paper and pencils and asks the girls to remember a special day in their lives and depict it in a storyboard.
Today you can imagine that you're being a director or a storyteller and you like to tell a story to the rest of the world, okay?
These drawings will later be used in a theater piece that the girls will create together. But before long, the hour is up, time for the real fun to begin. Suited up in helmets as well as knee and elbow pads, the girls enter the skate park, a huge covered gymnasium filled with wooden ramps of all sizes. Some wear their headscarves under their helmets, which fly behind them like the tail of a kite. Another volunteer, Robin Thompson, stands by to help with the more advanced students.
What they're doing is they're standing on the board sideways, which is also called primo, and it's a good way to establish balance early on in skateboarding.
One of the advanced students is 12-year-old Fazila, a thin girl who rides her board as if she was born on it, though she's only been skating a few months.
I come from a family of nine. My brother and I are the only ones who can work, and we both support the family by selling chewing gum. There's no way I could afford a skateboard of my own, so I'm glad I can come here, even if it's just once a week.
She says she's made the sort of friends here that she would never have made selling gum on the street.
I meet other girls of many different backgrounds. No one looks down on me because I have to work. I have a lot of friends here.
Sophie's skateboarding lesson is short and sweet, and then she releases the girls for the free-for-all part of the session. Soon they're flying in every direction. I'm caught in the middle of them, and it's like being in the center of a meteor shower. Sophie pulls me to the sidelines to avoid getting hit. Now and then a skateboarder wipes out, but they all get back on their boards. 17-year-old Mersal is the only boy here today. Because of security concerns, boys and girls don't skate together here, though they often do so in public places. Like Fazila, Mersal is from a poor background. He used to be addicted to sniffing glue before he discovered skateboarding. Now he helps teach and gets paid to clean up after sessions. He admits it was odd the first time he saw a girl ride a skateboard, but now he's used to it.
I think it's great that girls are skateboarding. I know they get funny looks on the streets, but they should do it, if their family doesn't mind. Girls are human. They should be able to skate like anyone else.
All too soon, the hour is up. Exhausted and exhilarated, the girls take off their helmets and pads and turn in their boards. Some will head home to Kabul's better neighborhoods. Others to jobs selling tea or chewing gum in the streets. But they've all got something in common. They can't wait for next Sunday to get here. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Kabul, Afghanistan.
That's the sound of Kabul Dreams, rocking and rolling in Afghanistan. And it's the subject of this week's Globe at a Glance. It's not easy being a rock star in Afghanistan. Many Afghans disapprove of rock music. They think it's too Western and too provocative. Plus, it's hard to hold concerts because of security threats. So Kabul Dreams, a band who claims to be the first and only rock group in Afghanistan, is working hard to build a following. They perform in front of audiences made up mostly of aid workers, expats, and educated young Afghans. The trio come from three different ethnic groups and speak three different languages, Pashto, Dari, and Uzbek, but they sing in English. They say their goal is to show Afghan youth that people from different tribes can work and play together in harmony. That's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymire. If you've walked through Nordstrom's lately, you may have noticed a beautiful new line of necklaces in the jewelry department. They're from Guatemala. They're handmade, and they come to the U.S. through Mercado Global. That's a project started by an American college student who was looking for ways to help the Highland women of Guatemala. We talked with Ruth DeGoya a few years ago, and we thought we'd check in with her again to find out how things are going. Ruth, it's nice to speak with you again.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So last time we talked, you had a few American companies, and I think you were mostly selling the women's jewelry and crafts on the internet, right?
Yeah, that's right. And since then, we've actually partnered directly with a number of major department stores and specialty retail chains here in the U.S. So our latest partnership, which we're really excited about, is Nordstrom's.
That's a pretty big store. That's a big deal.
Absolutely. And actually, our first collection is in stores now. And the necklaces that the artisans are selling are actually called the Delia. And it's named after one of the artisans in one of the new groups that we were able to partner with because of this partnership with Nordstrom's.
Describe it for me. How would it stand out from the rest of the jewelry there?
The artisan's jewelry really stands out because it's so beautiful and colorful, and it's very prominently featured. So if you walk in, you'll see these gorgeous bib necklaces, which are 11 strands of beautiful Japanese seed beads.
Now, why are the Guatemalan women using Japanese beads? Do you import these from Japan?
Yes. And actually, that's part of what makes this model work. I think the way that we've been able to connect women in Guatemala to major companies here in the U.S. is we develop partnerships with major designers in the U.S. who come down to work with the women. And unfortunately, one thing that's rather sad is in Latin America, there are not a lot of sources of high-quality raw materials. So what we do is we import higher quality raw materials for the women so that they can have products that are at the level needed by Nordstrom's, Levi Strauss, Bloomingdale's.
So you're working with Bloomingdale's as well as Nordstrom?
Yeah, it's really exciting. With Bloomingdale's, we're doing trunk shows with them across the country.
So you're sending American jewelry designers down to Guatemala into these villages to work with the women about how to design these necklaces?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And each piece draws on the culture and the traditional craftsmanship of the women that we're working with, but it also has a modern design element so that it's really going to sell very well in the U.S. too.
Ruth, can you give me a feel of how many women you have enrolled in this program?
We work with just about 400 women, and that includes jewelry groups, weaving groups, sewing groups. So another one of our big partners, for example, is Levi Strauss, and we do actually both women's scarves and men's scarves with them. So this fall, their entire scarf, men's scarf collection is woven by the women that we work with.
Wow. And so I'm assuming this has really changed the life of these women, the lives of these women, because their incomes have, I'm assuming, dramatically increased. Can you give us a feel for how this has changed their lives economically?
One of the things we do every summer is we do a social impact assessment of all of the communities where we work so that we really can see what is the impact we're having. We find that the first two places that money is going, that Mercado Global sales income is going, is, first of all, to send all of their kids to school for the second year in a row, all children of elementary school age, and about 80% of middle school age children in our communities are in school. And that's a really big deal in a country where indigenous children receive, on average, just 1.3 years of education.
Are you talking, referring just to the children of the women who are making the necklaces or all the children in their villages?
That's at a community level, because actually our scholarship program is focused on children who aren't in our partner cooperatives. So unfortunately, there are a lot of orphans in the communities where we work. So the first thing is all the kids are going to school. And then the second thing is moms are starting to go to the market once a week and buy things like fruits and meats, which before, unfortunately, they did not have the opportunity to purchase. So we're having a really big impact on nutritional rates and consequently on health and well-being in the communities where we work.
We should probably tell people how you got into this. You were a student at Yale, and didn't this just start as a school project for you?
Absolutely. I actually had a fellowship to work in Guatemala's highlands with an association of rural indigenous communities. It's a kind of interesting story because at the time I sort of thought of myself as a pure activist, and I never would have thought that I would be basically a businesswoman. But going into all the communities where we were working, where in some communities there were no men because they'd been killed during massacres in the Civil War, and after we did a community health workshop or a gender workshop, without fail, every single community, the moms would come up to me and say, Ruth, you know, can you take some of our artesanías back in your luggage and sell them wherever you come from? And I think for me, I really felt that it was so important because these women had gone through so much. And it was very hard for me to watch them feel that they basically had to beg for help because they had no sources of income. So developing that market connection was so empowering for them. And that was the birth of Mercado Global.
Ruth DeGolia is founder and director of Mercado Global. Ruth, it was great to catch up with you again.
Thank you so much.
In Argentina, construction workers have a special tradition. After a long week of hard work, they relax on Saturdays by having a barbecue. Reporter Marcos Fetterman recently dropped in on one in a small town just north of Buenos Aires.
In the town of Ingeniero Maschwitz, about a dozen workers put on the last details of a large house they've been building for the last 6 months. Some guys are on the roof. Some are laying the last bricks of the trail that runs across the garden. And that's where Ricardo Alfaro is, standing next to a portable grill. He is in charge of today's barbecue.
I've been a construction worker for 20 years. I always worked in construction. Alejandro is my superior, and he's the one who taught me how to work in this business.
And he also taught Ricardo how to barbecue. The gatherings are an opportunity for the men to enjoy some camaraderie and downtime.
We get paid on Saturdays, and that's when we barbecue. We Argentinians love barbecue. In construction work, we say, to be happy, we have to have our strong traditional tea, mate. We have to have the radio on, and we have to have a barbecue to make it perfect.
Ricardo is patient with the meat he is grilling. He says the longer it takes, the better it will taste. Other workers told me he is a great cook, but Ricardo is also a humble man.
This process doesn't have many secrets. When the embers are ready, you put the salted meat on the grill. It has to roast very slowly. You can't be in a hurry because you will burn the meat.
There are many choices of meat cuts in Argentine butcher shops. Ricardo is cooking one called falda.
This meat is cut from near the ribs. Now we have to be patient. That's all.
After 1 hour, the meat is ready. Ricardo calls the other workers over, and they all gather around the grill. Each cuts off a piece of meat that's eaten off of a piece of bread. No plates or forks are used. This way of eating the meat is a tradition that goes back 200 years, when the gauchos, the cowboys of Argentina, would cook their meat. But in those days, they would use their fighting knives to cut off their portions. As they sit on paint buckets they use as benches, all the men seem happy, not only for the barbecue, but because after 6 months, the house is almost finished. The owners arrive and are invited to join the workers. The couple say they've already eaten and regret it because the meat looks so good. In Argentina, construction workers are considered part of the lower class, a group of people once known as los humildes, the humble ones. And Ricardo says that today, with unemployment in his line of work very high, it is still a good way to be.
You cannot be arrogant. You have to be humble, like a dog. When you pet a dog, he lies down on his back and shows his belly.
And when it comes to his barbecue skills, well, he is a humble man about that too.
I won't say I'm the best barbecue man, but I can hold my own.
For the World Vision Report, I am Marcos Federman in Ingeniero Maschwitz, Argentina.
Argentina is the land of the tango. You can find people dancing it from rural villages to sophisticated cities. The dance originated with immigrants in Buenos Aires, and for a long time, the tango was associated with Argentina's underclass. Now the tango is popular all around the world. We leave you today with some tango music. This is a group of musicians playing on the streets of San Telmo in Buenos Aires. You can hear more music from Argentina on our website, worldvisionreport.org. While you're there, sign up for a podcast so you can take us with you. The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.